Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What's that? You say you're stuck in a presidential election and you need to score some quick points? Hey, China is always a handy target. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 17th of September. Good to have you with us. The great state of Ohio has a twofer going for it this election season. One, it's a swing state, so voters there will get more than the usual amount of attention from the presidential candidates this fall. And number two, one of its key industries has been, for want of a better word, walloped by a recession and overseas competition. I'm talking here about cars and the manufacturing thereof. During a campaign stop in Cincinnati today, President Obama announced a new trade complaint against China, targeting what the White House calls illegal Chinese subsidies for its auto and auto parts exports. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner gets us going today.
Brake systems, powertrains, steering wheels, this stuff is big business for the U.S., but U.S. trade officials complain in the last few years the Chinese have been flooding the world with cheap auto parts. Scott Paul is executive director of the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Each of the last 2 years, they've come in at about 25% greater than the last year.
U.S. trade officials say China is methodically setting up export bases, regions where companies get special cash grants, tax breaks, and other subsidies designed specifically for exports. That's a violation of WTO rules, they say. American manufacturers blame the subsidies for job losses in the Midwest. But analyst Daniel Rosen of the Rhodium Group says, don't forget about that little thing called the Great Recession.
It would be very dangerous to assume that China's policies, no matter how inappropriate under WTO rules, were the only explanation for job concerns in Ohio.
Job-killing automation and rising health care costs contributed too, says Rosen. Trade expert Gary Huffbauer says this is the 15th time the U.S. has lodged a WTO challenge against China.
And China's lost a fair number of those.
And when China loses, says Huffbauer, it's made a serious effort to comply, at least enough to satisfy the world's trade police. Until the next time. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
You can blame China for the economic problems we're having, or you could look a little bit closer to home.
Banks got bailed out. We got sold out.
That was just part of the scene in Lower Manhattan today. Protests celebrating the year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. By most accounts, the protests were smaller than they were a year ago, more heavily policed, too. Whether or not they turn into something bigger remains, of course, to be seen. But we wanted to explore how much, or even if, Occupy changed people who were on opposite sides of those protests last fall. We've called two people who maybe don't talk to each other all that often, a business leader and an Occupy protester. Kathy Wild is the president and CEO of Partnership NYC. She's also on the board of directors of the New York Federal Reserve, although I should note she is not speaking on their behalf today. J.A. Meyerson is with Occupy Wall Street. He's down in Zuccotti Park. It's good to have you both with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Kathy Wild, let me ask you, in the year or so since the original Occupy and then since the time it faded from the streets, have you thought about it much in the past year?
Well, I think that the Occupy movement last year really set a conversation going that has continued. New York City is not a Tea Party town. There's a lot of sympathy for unemployed Americans. Our unemployment rate in New York City is 10%, significantly higher than the country. In many communities of color, it's 30 to 40%. And I think the Occupy movement forced the conversation on all of us about what has happened in this country in terms of average incomes not going up and not being able to look forward to a every American being able to work hard and make it into the middle class.
J.A., do you think you've been heard by Kathy Wild and the business groups that she is associated with and the one she leads?
Well, no. I mean, I think that the answer that Occupy started a conversation that shifted national attention to income inequality actually wasn't the intention of the Occupy movement. It was the intention of the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party has successfully managed to change the conversation to that. Really, what the Occupy movement wanted to do was start a much more fundamental conversation about the primacy of the profit motive and the capture of the functions of the state by the interests of capital. Capital and trying to move, as the protesters say in the streets today and on other days, another world is possible.
Well, if you guys have been co-opted by the Democratic Party, I have to ask you whether or not you blew it.
I think that the Democrats' attempts to incorporate some of the messaging of Occupy Wall Street into their campaigns will ultimately fall short when everyone sees that actually the fundamentals are not changing.
Kathy, what do you think of what J.A. said there? I mean, this idea that and I don't want to get all political here, but the idea that the Democrats co-opted Occupy Wall Street and its message.
Well, I think to the extent that the Occupy group wants to take down capitalism, Lower Manhattan is probably the wrong place to do it. Wall Street is, in fact, responsible for 500,000 jobs of New Yorkers. It generates about 1/4 of our city's tax revenues. And New Yorkers complain about the banks as much as anyone else, but just about everybody here has a relative or friend who works for one. I think that there's something of a disconnect between the priorities of New York and New Yorkers and the agenda that it sounds like J.A. is focused on.
Don't you think that's kind of their point, though, to get people away from the standard method of thinking?
Well, as I say, I think this is probably the wrong place and the wrong time to be doing that.
J.A., let me ask you what might seem like a silly question, but how often do you actually interact with bankers and Wall Street and business types? I mean, have you ever talked to one of them?
Sure, yeah. And in fact, there are a number of bankers and former Wall Street employees, including CDS traders, who have joined the movement. I will note, though, that bankers are a notoriously insular group that is essentially impervious to public feedback. Dick Fuld of Lehman Brothers famously had his own private elevator.
Yeah, look at what happened to Dick Fuld.
Right.
Kathy, last question to you. Did you go down to Zuccotti Park last fall and look around at all? Did you talk to any of these guys?
I have, yes.
What'd you think?
I think that they're expressing a frustration, a sentiment. But I do also think that we ought to be very clear that the entire country benefits from the fact that New York City is the world financial capital. And so long as we live in a global economy, I think we want to keep it that way.
All right. We'll leave it there. Kathy Wild is the president of the Partnership for New York City. It's a business leadership group in New York. J.A. Meyerson. We got him down at Zuccotti Park. He's with the Occupy movement. Thanks very much, the both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kai.
Just down the block from Zuccotti Park at the corner of Wall Street and Broad, traders were kind of oblivious to the whole thing, really. Details, numbers, when we get there. I'm not really going to set up this next story as much as I am going to give you a hint of what it's about. A certain plentiful yet much in demand natural resource has been seeing shortages the past couple of years.
And as a result, prices have been rising like never before. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has the story.
Call it a ballooning crisis. Mark Hannon hasn't seen his profits escaping like this in 16 years of running Balloon Express, a party shop near Cleveland, Ohio. He weathered the Great Recession, in large part, he thinks, because balloons were cheaper than flowers. But the uncertainty over helium supplies has changed that equation.
Even in a down economy, we were always busy. Now, with the helium shortage, I don't even know if the order that I've got booked until November, I'm going to have helium for.
As recently as 6 months ago, he sold balloons for around $12 a dozen. Now that price has tripled, and he's getting some strong reactions.
Are you crazy? What do you mean $36? What else do I get with it?
Consider that party balloons account for less than 1% of helium demand, and you've got the makings of a global crisis. Sam Burton of the Federal Helium Reserve, the government stockpile, says that's because industrial demand for the stuff keeps growing.
It's used in computer chip manufacture, cell phones, fiber optic cables, laser production. If it's high-tech, helium's in there somewhere in its production. It's vital.
Burton says supply just isn't keeping up with all that demand, even though helium can be captured as a waste product from natural gas fields. But natural gas prices are at historic lows, so Burton says producers are less interested in doing that. At Pennsylvania-based Air Products and Chemicals, John Van Sloan says help is on the way, but it may take a while.
There are some new plants that are scheduled to be started up in the next year or so, which will certainly help alleviate some of the tightness in the marketplace.
Meantime, though, analysts say prices are bound to keep rising, just like those balloons. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Best part of that balloon gag, by the way, the first balloon place we went to, they were out of helium. Go figure. All right, it's less than a month until the start of the National Hockey League season, but if the past couple of days are any indication, nobody is going to be picking up a puck anytime soon. Negotiations in the two-day-old NHL lockout seem to be going nowhere, and it's a shame for fans, sure. A public relations problem for players and owners, absolutely. A real pinch, though, for governments and businesses that make money off that game. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has the story.
Let's start with one community where we've got hard data. Michael Ndolo is with the economic development consultancy Camoin Associates. He recently looked at the impact of the New York Islanders. His forecast is grim if the season is lost.
We would estimate that a total of about $62 million of spending would be lost to the county.
Also, about 1,000 jobs, including those at hotels, restaurants, and sporting goods stores. And that's just the Long Island impact. Brad Rosen co-owns Sports World in Chicago. He's worried about goods gathering dust.
I got to imagine it's going to cut my business in half for Blackhawks as it is until the season starts. And then if they were to cancel the whole season, you know, it's going to take years to come back as it did last time.
He's at least lucky that hockey jersey maker Reebok is giving him something of a break. Normally, Rosen has to pay for merchandise within 30 days, but now he doesn't owe Reebok until a month after the lockout ends. But that's no help if you're selling burgers and beer. Rick Medina is bar manager at Edison Ale House, right beside the New Jersey Devils Arena.
I think it's definitely going to hurt us. Devils fans are very loyal to their team. They come in here, spend their money, have a good time, and we're definitely going to miss that.
If there's no NHL season, there's still business from concerts and other events. But Medina knows hockey fans put away a lot more beer than people attending Disney on Ice. If Mickey and Goofy are the only stars strapping on skates, it's going to be a tough year for a lot of businesses. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, what do you say? Got time for a quick 18 holes?
To take your whole morning, or your whole day, to go play golf is just laughable.
Making golf a fast-paced game. Coming up, but first, yeah, let's do the numbers. Stocks ended a four-day rally today as euphoria over QE3 faded a bit. The Dow Industrial's off 40 points, 0.3%, closed at 13,553. The blue chips did. The S&P 500 off 5 points. A 10%, 1461. The S&P 500 off 4 points. 0.3% finished at 3178. Raw material and steel providers were among the biggest drags on the market today. Shares of U.S. Steel rusted out more than 4% on concerns of softening global demand. Coal and iron ore producer Cliffs Natural Resources crumbled 7%. One of the few bright spots today? Yeah, big shocker. Apple shares polished up 1.25% on blockbuster pre-orders for the iPhone 5. Touched, in fact, got over $700 a share at one point, closed just below that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Home Builders reports on builder confidence in the single-family housing market for September. On September 18th, 1851, the New York Times first published. Back then it was the New York Daily Times. And The Sopranos star James Gandolfini turns 51. Happy birthday. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There have been more protests today in the Middle East and across parts of the Muslim world. The violence over an anti-Islam film that started last week has been a sharp reminder to businesses of the risks that can come with moving into new markets. But if they're doing it right, uprisings and unrest are all part of the calculus that companies go through when they decide to expand overseas. From Washington, Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Last week, when the unrest started, Kelly Gordon was in Cairo. She's an executive with a manufacturer called Cummins. The company has a distributor in Egypt.
Probably even before the events hit the news, I began to get the emails and the SMSs from our internal security officers.
Gordon was traveling with a delegation of 50 U.S. companies.
Part of our business planning is thinking about the contingencies that we need to put in place to deal with the risks that are inherent in dealing with this market.
Those risks, Gordon says, are outweighed by the rewards of doing business in Egypt. Jeff Porter does risk consulting in North Africa, and he says that when there's unrest, different companies react differently. If they have a presence in the region,
then they'd have to, you know, reassess what their security profile is.
They do this every time there's turmoil. Porter says other businesses aren't as used to unrest.
If you're a company that is considering North Africa for the first time, then this is going to give you pause, and it may encourage a company to postpone its plans for entering North Africa until things settle down into a more predictable trajectory.
That might take 6 months or a year. Morris DeFeo heads the Middle East and North Africa practice for a law firm called Crowell & Mooring. He says companies considering doing business in Egypt also take the opportunity to look at regulatory security, at things like transparency and accountability.
Then you take the long view, and I think you bide your time and you invest accordingly.
And in a developing market like Egypt, a country with a population of 82 million people, DeFeo says there are still significant opportunities for growth. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The teacher strike in Chicago entered its second week this morning. A tentative deal failed to attract union support over the weekend. And this afternoon, Mayor Rahm Emanuel wasn't able to convince a state court to declare the strike illegal and force teachers to go back to the classroom. There is another teacher strike going on, one that's getting a lot less attention. It's up in the well-to-do North Chicago suburb of Lake Forest. Today, the district there took the unusual step of holding classes anyway. From the education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
Lake Forest High School teachers have been on strike over their pay since last Wednesday, but today school was back in session. Officials promised a full day of instructional programming provided by substitute teachers and volunteers who crossed the picket line. Attendance mandatory.
From what we're hearing from the kids, there were videos being shown.
And the highlight of the day, apparently, is when they had a police dog come in because the dog was so cute.
That's math teacher Chuck Gress with Karina Richter, the parent of a student who graduated last year. They spoke to me from the picket line as a crowd waved signs outside the school. Some have dubbed Lake Forest High a scab school, but that's not how Gress, a teacher for 20 years, sees it.
The people in that building right now, the administrators, are among my friends. I mean, it has got to be one of the worst days ever at Lake Forest High School for those administrators. And I know that when this whole thing is settled, we're going to have to pick up the pieces.
School administrators did not return calls asking for comment. Michael Griffith is with the nonpartisan Education Commission of the States. He says keeping school open means the district doesn't have to make up the days later or risk losing state funding. But teachers lose the chance to get paid for those makeup days.
They can then use this as leverage against the teachers, because now every day that the teachers miss is a potential lost day in their pay.
A few parents I heard from were happy the school was open. They didn't have to make other arrangements. But eventually, Griffith says, they'll want their kids learning again. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Here in California this November, voters could be the first to approve a new law requiring all genetically modified foods to be labeled as such. GMOs, as they're known, genetically modified organisms, get their start the same way most foods do, as a simple seed. Janice Ray spends a lot of her time with seeds, thinking about them, planting them, and writing about them. In her new book, it's called The Seed Underground. Janice, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
How did we used to take care of our seeds? I mean, it wasn't so long ago that farmers, you know, they didn't keep them in their pocket quite, but they were responsible for their own stuff.
It wasn't that long ago, in the last 100, 200 years, exactly. Farmers couldn't run down in their jalopies to the feed store and buy new patented versions of seeds like they can now. Farmers had to be caretakers, not so much renters of this genetic material they were using.
That's a good phrase, renters of seeds. That's kind of what happens now, right?
Yeah, with the advent of patenting laws and the ability to patent life, basically, lots of traditional varieties have been patented, and then lots of new technologically produced varieties patented. But a patent supersedes the rights of a farmer to save his or her own seeds.
How does it work now on a corn farm or a tomato farm or a strawberry farm or whatever it is? I mean, how do farmers get their seeds now?
So what a farmer would do would be contract with a large seed company and usually be growing a genetically modified seed. Now, what I looked at in the book is I got to travel around to gardens across the country, and these gardeners I call quiet revolutionaries who are still keeping alive these old place-based vintage traditional varieties, sometimes family heirlooms and sometimes simply open pollinated varieties no longer found or found very seldom on the marketplace.
Obviously, the big agribusinesses and, you know, Monsanto and all those guys, I mean, you're not huge fans of theirs, but are they, in your view, are they bad? Are they evil? Are they doing wrong?
I'm not opposed to technology or science. I believe science should be used for the good of all humanity over the long run. I'm opposed to science and technology being used for short-term profits. So I'm not going to use the word evil. I can say that hybrid seeds have brought us a lot of good, and perhaps GM could. I think there are more questions than answers about genetically modified organisms at this point.
Janice Ray, her book is called The Seed Underground. Janice, thanks a lot.
The pleasure was mine.
The National Golf Foundation has some distressing news for those used to cutting business deals on the back nine. Seems something like 5 million players have left the sport in the past 10 years. Schmoozing somebody on the course is as old a tradition as there is in business. Colorado Public Radio's Zachary Barr reports that the slow-moving and honestly kind of frustrating sport of golf is making some changes to try to get people back.
So a realtor, insurance agent, and mortgage broker meet up before work. They want to get a little exercise, talk business, and compete against their pals. And if a little networking comes of it, all the better. Their activity? It used to be golf.
Golf is frustrating unless you're on the top of your game.
I mean, all of us have younger kids, and I think it becomes a time constraint.
It's frustrating, and it's you know, let's face it, it's somewhat expensive, too.
Steve Remmert, Greg Naber, and Noel Bennett, they've all given up golf. Now they meet twice a week to go cycling. They ride for a couple of hours in the mountains around Boulder. They do it because golf costs too much, it's too difficult, and it takes too long to play.
So a bike ride early in the morning when you can be back by 8 o'clock is reasonable.
That assessment is not coming from another cycling enthusiast. It's from the executive director of the Colorado Golf Association. Ed Mate says golf's problems go deeper. The sport's key demographic, men who are fathers, just won't leave their families for hours like they used to.
To take your whole morning or your whole day to go play golf is just laughable. You know, that's a non-starter. That is the biggest challenge by far.
So what's being done about that?
Well, not a lot. There's a lot of discussion about reconfiguring golf courses to make four-hole loops and three-hole loops so you can go out and play, you know, so you're gone for an hour.
But that idea, which is happening some, isn't as simple as it sounds. You see, golf courses are designed for everyone to play 9 or 18. Play just three and you cause a traffic jam. And many courses aren't rushing to remodel just so they can charge less money for fewer holes. So what can golf do? golf pro Joe Bailing's at his golf course in Aurora, Colorado. He's standing at the start of the 18th hole.
As you can see, we have the black tees, the gold tees, and the white tees. There's also a set of ladies' tees that are even more forward than these here.
These different sets of tees are spaced 10 to 20 yards apart, and that's nothing new. But now the big golf associations are imploring people to choose a tee that's closer to the hole. It's called Tee It Forward. It shrinks the course and makes the game easier and quicker. Joe Bailing thinks it's a great idea, but
I'd say 75 to 80% of the people do not listen and just kind of go play where they think that they should be playing from.
There's another push called It's Okay Rules. Daryl Krall with the PGA of America says the idea is to make golf less frustrating.
Bunker shots can be difficult for beginners, and after you try a couple times, you can pick it up and throw it on the green.
Other efforts lower prices and recruit new players. Krall says all of this is necessary for golf to reverse its decline. So will this lure back golfers who've broken up with the sport? Well, do you remember Noel Bennett, one of the guys who dumped golf for cycling? When he heard golf wanted him back, he said,
"Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I do miss it, actually, when I see people and I drive by and they're out there playing. It looks nice and relaxing, but it's not going to happen."
I don't know, golf. Noel sounds a little wistful. Maybe you should keep calling. In Boulder, I'm Zachary Barr for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with the caveat that I don't invent the news, I just tell you what it is. The fourth richest woman in the country is in the news today. Elaine Tetimer Marshall is her name. She's 70 years old, and Bloomberg reports she owns 15% of Koch Industries, a stake worth almost $13 billion. The funny part of all this is that despite her wealth, which she got following the death of her husband, E. Pierce Marshall, we have never heard much about her, even though her money has been at the center of two Supreme Court cases involving her mother-in-law. Maybe you've heard of her, Anna Nicole Smith. Yeah, thought so. All right, we're done. Today, the Dow off 40 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ off 5 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 down 4 points. That is 0.3%. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Liza Madry, and Jolie Podokas. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.